but with the stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public.
For how many years you kept these photos in secret? How many years did
60.
Building?
They?
Did you went inside?
I haven't seen my own project since then. I couldn't go in all these years.
When President Kennedy took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. At the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the US Secretary of Defense informs the president that based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. They were unaware of the 6 floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we travelled to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xanthe Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Xanthe Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission Against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona. Its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact? What are they doing about cooling? Where is the nuclear waste being stored? How is it being stored? And all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
Why do you think that the international community behaves with Israel in this special way?
First of all, we are not obliged. We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US. And the third thing is the Holocaust.
How?
Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist, specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media and so on. We know only when they have settlements, when the courts say settlement, that they give some money, but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what conditions. And also their doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumours and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea, because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better, but there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
Our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Daria, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Daria, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
Thank you. In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water-soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. And you also have muscles in certain organs, like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up. And at that point, it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my estimations, are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor. And the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take lead samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area, because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel? And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one of funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel, because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got. And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. If they were rich people, they wouldn't live next to a reactor, I guess. They wouldn't be depending on this reactor for their livelihood. A few years ago, they all got iodine pills that were very old iodine pills, and that was it. And they're not asking, and that's the problem, that they are more afraid to talk about it than the radiation.
But there are more cases around Palestine. In a small village lost in Al-Khalil Hills, there are other victims. One of them has already died. His son fears the consequences of telling his father's story and only accepts to talk if we protect his identity. The medical report from a Jordanian hospital is clear. This former Dimona employee suffered from cancer. Officially, nobody claims that Dimona is the cause. This and many other cases come from the same region. Israeli nuclear program is surrounded by a novel atmosphere. This man is Arnon Milchan, famous Hollywood producer behind films like Pretty Woman, Club of Fighters, or LA Confidential. But there is no story like that of Mordecai Vanunus. Vanunu was a nuclear technician in Dimona till 1985. Before quitting, he snapped two rolls of film at a top-secret nuclear plant. The world was stunned when the Sunday Times published Vanunu's story and photos, exposing for the first time the secrets of Israel's nuclear arsenal in October 1986. But Israeli intelligence found Mordecai Vanunu, and they waited for the right moment to strike. They sent a woman agent to seduce Mordecai Vanunu in London and convince him to travel with her to Rome. Vanunu was vulnerable and afraid and fell for Mossad's honey trap. When the article was published on October the 5th, 1986, Vanunu had vanished. His kidnap, an illegal act on foreign soil, was kept secret. Later, when Vanunu appeared for a secret court session in Jerusalem al-Quds, he found a way to reveal what had happened to him since he left London. Writing on his hand, Vanunu M was hijacked in Rome. Vanunu's trial was held in secret. He was found guilty of treason and espionage and sentenced to 18 years in jail, 11 of them in solitary confinement. The woman that seduced Vanunu was Cheryl Bentov. After she completed her mission, she disappeared back into her secret world. Today, she lives back in Orlando, USA, with her husband and two daughters, running a real estate business. Vanunu's revelations confirmed suspicions and showed a weapons program bigger and more advanced than anyone had previously thought. Mordecai Vanunu was released in 2004, but he is not a free man. Israeli borders are now his prison. His passport was confiscated and he cannot contact foreigners.
This Jewish state have 200 atomic weapons, have hydrogen bomb, atomic weapons, neutron bomb, and they are not able to say they have the bomb. They are not able to destroy anyone. They are not able to use the bomb. Instead, they arrest Vanunu Mordecai.
What we are going to see now is something that has never been shown in a non-Israeli TV channel. A 3D tour inside the Israeli bomb factory, recreated thanks to the photos taken by Mordecai Vanunu. This is Institute Number 1, Dimona's symbol, the only building seen from far away. A 20 metres high nuclear reactor dome. In 1986, Vanunu took us inside. A heavy water reactor built in the 50s with France and Norway's help, with a capacity of 24 megawatts. Thanks to Vanunu, we learned that this reactor capacity is three or possibly even five times larger than assumed. This reactor produces 40 kilograms of plutonium a year, enough to build 10 to 12 atomic bombs. Adjacent to the reactor is Institute Number 3. Here, the fuel rods powering the reactor are produced, together with lithium-6, another ingredient of the bomb. This is Institute Number 5. Here, the fuel rods are coated with the aluminium. Institute Number 6 is the power station of the compound. The lab is in Institute Number 8, and inside is another secret revealed by Mordecai Vanunu. This is where Israel produces enriched uranium. Like plutonium, it can serve as fissionable material for the bomb. The uranium is produced through gas centrifuges. Enriched uranium is also produced in Institute Number 9 using laser a unique Israeli patent. Institute No. 10 produces the depleted uranium, an important component in the production of armor-piercing shells. Institute No. 4 handles the radiation waste prior to it being disposed. And this long two-story building with no windows is Dimona's biggest secret. Institute No. 2. Beneath the two innocent-looking floors, hidden underground are six additional floors. It was Vanunu who showed the world what no satellite could see. Here, Israel set up a plutonium separation facility with one goal, the manufacturing of atomic bombs.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the issue of Palestine. Everyone should realize that the world superpowers' aim to create Israel does not end in the occupation of Palestine. They plan, heaven forbid, extending the fate of Palestine to all Arab countries. If every Muslim throws a bucket of water on Israel, Israel will be washed away. It is the intonation of Allahu Akbar, the cry of our nation, that disappointed the Shah in Iran and would disappoint the usurpers in Palestine.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from Arab English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain sentences and speeches of the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh. On the subject of Palestine and the Quds, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "We are on the side of the oppressed, whichever pole they may be in. The Palestinians are oppressed by the Israelis. Therefore, we side with them." Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh understood the depth of the Palestinian issue. He called for the movement in defense of Palestine and the world's oppressed people. He viewed the issue of Palestine as a fundamental and strategic Muslim world issue. And of course, the Islamic Revolution of Iran and its leadership have always supported all oppressed people's struggles against the world arrogance. But Palestine has a special place in this. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh always considered returning to Islam and uniting as a prerequisite to saving Palestine and blocking Zionism's expansionist plans. Consequently, while stressing that the main goal of Israel is the destruction of Islam, he repeatedly called on the Muslims to put aside all their differences, including the religious ones.
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله
صلى الله عليه
صل
يا رسول الله
يا ربنا صل
Even though the majority of the Arabs and Muslim living in Palestine belong to the Sunni sect, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, in his role as Shi'i jurisprudent and marja', did not refuse them any kind of help. He considered the issue of Palestine as one that was related to the very existence of Islam and stressed that it was a problem which concerned the Islamic world as a whole. He encouraged all Muslims to extend their help to the Palestinians. He held that the necessary requirement for being able to adopt a basic stance on Israel and pursue a serious struggle against it are that the people, while being aware of the facts, should at the same time not be stricken with consumption, fervor, and should trust their leaders to the extent that they go along and should trust their leaders to the extent that they go along and cooperate with them. Thank you very much, dear listeners. I hope that you have enjoyed this episode of Spring of the Truth. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The British government's anti-BDS bill that intends to ban local public bodies from joining the popular boycott campaign against the Israeli regime threatens to erode democratic values, restrict freedom of expression, and undermine campaigns for social justice. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Middle East Monitor has covered this story and tells us more. A large number of students in a show of solidarity with Palestine at over 20 universities across the United Kingdom have called for divestment from Israeli apartheid regime and urged their vice-chancellors to oppose the oppressive anti-BDS bill. In a statement released on Wednesday, 4th of October, Friends of Al-Aqsa said a Palestine Day of Action had been coordinated to denounce a parliamentary bill that seeks to ban public bodies from boycotting Israeli goods. The Friends of Al-Aqsa said in a statement, the anti-BDS bill threatens the rights of public bodies, including universities, to divest from Israeli companies involved in inflicting apartheid on Palestinian men, women and children. In June, the British government introduced a parliamentary bill that seeks to ban public bodies from boycotting Israeli goods, sparking outcry from Palestinian advocacy groups and human rights activists. Under the guise of anti-Semitic rhetoric and abuse, the legislation will prevent public organisations in the United Kingdom from boycotting the apartheid Israeli regime through sanctions and divestment campaigns. The statement noted students from Kent to Newcastle will urge their vice-chancellors to oppose this dangerous legislation, and students across the country will call for their institutions to divest from companies complicit in Israeli human rights abuses in Palestine, including companies like Rolls-Royce PLC, Hewlett-Packard, British Aerospace Systems and Booking.com. Friends of Al-Aqsa added, Rolls-Royce manufactures crucial components of the F-35 joint strike fighters used by Israel to attack the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Hewlett-Packard maintains hardware for the Israeli police, who enforce apartheid on Palestinians within the occupied territories. Pro-Palestinian activists say Britain's anti-BDS bill gives Israel protective shield over crimes. Aisha, an undergraduate student at Salford University in Manchester, said, "As students at Salford, we are here today to make it clear that it's unacceptable for our university to fund human rights abuses. We came here to learn, not to fund apartheid. Our vice-chancellor must act now. He must divest from unethical investments and stand up for the right to boycott the apartheid regime of Israel." The Palestinian Authority's foreign ministry has called on all countries to put individuals tied to settler terrorist organizations or companies investing in illegal Israeli settlements across the occupied Palestinian territories on their terror lists. This comes as the Israeli regime has been pressing ahead with its illegal settlement expansion in the Palestinian territories despite international outcry. The policy has seen the support of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist cabinet. The United Nations has already published a list of companies with business ties to Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. The international pro-Palestinian boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, has said the database was a very significant first concrete step by any United Nations entity towards holding to account Israel and its international corporations. The website of Press TV has also covered this story and tells us more. The British government's move to table a bill in the Parliament that intends to ban local public bodies from joining the popular boycott campaign against the Israeli regime threatens to erode democratic values, restrict freedom of expression, and undermine campaigns for social justice. Rani Ahmadi, a legal advisor to the United Nations and the European Union, who previously served as the United Nations legal advocacy representative of BADIL, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights, made these remarks in an interview with Iran's English-language television Press TV. The Ramallah-born activist and attorney remarked, "We Palestinians, lawyers, activists from all over the world and civil societies are deeply concerned by the government's anti-boycott bill, which threatens to erode local democracy, restrict freedom of expression under Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and undermine campaigns for social and climate justice. The Economic Activity of Public Bodies Bill, which opposes boycotts of the Israeli regime, was introduced in the British Parliament, the House of Commons, recently, sparking a massive outcry. Justifying the move, UK Communities Secretary Michael Gove claimed in a statement recently, "These campaigns not only undermine Britain's foreign policy, but lead to appalling anti-Semitic rhetoric and abuse. That is why we have taken this decisive action to stop these disruptive policies once and for all." Rani Ahmadi, a legal advisor to the United Nations and the European Union, told Press TV's website that from the Balfour Declaration to the British Mandate of Palestine, Britain has played an irrefutable role in dispossessing Palestinians from their homeland, in Palestine's colonization and ethnic cleansing, and aiding the world's longest military occupation in history. She added, "We have to go to the root cause of the colonization, which goes back 106 years. She added, "Don't forget the Balfour Declaration, which called for the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. The British had no right, no authority or consent over to determine their destiny." The growing popularity of the movement has prompted governments in the West to curb its activities under the pressure of pro-Israel lobbies, with Britain's efforts spearheaded by Michael Gove and various other politicians. Rani Ahmadi said, "The boycott, divestment and sanctions movement, the BDS movement and other such campaigns have long been used to campaign peacefully for progressive change around the world." The new Arab website has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a legal opinion provided to the opposition Labour Party, free speech could be under threat if the British government's controversial anti-boycott bill becomes law. The advice from Matrix Chambers lawyer Richard Hermer KC was published recently ahead of the bill's second reading in the House of Commons. Like legal advice provided by another lawyer to Amnesty International, obtained by the New Arab recently, Richard Hermer, KC, raised the issue of freedom of expression under Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Richard Hermer, KC, said, "This very poorly drafted bill is likely to have a detrimental impact on the United Kingdom's ability to protect and promote human rights overseas. It is in certain respects inconsistent with our obligations under international law and will stifle free speech at home in a manner incompatible with Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights. It will take powers long exercised by local authorities into the hands of the Secretary of State and will likely lead to an array of illogical outcomes." Rivka Barnard, Deputy Director of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, called the proposed legislation repressive. She told the New Arab, "It is no surprise that legal experts have confirmed our position that the government's anti-boycott bill is incompatible with international laws and conventions on human rights, including, but not limited to, issues around freedom of expression."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to Islamic Upbringing, the show that offers you guidance on how to educate your children in accordance with Islam. We are here to listen to your questions and difficulties on this subject, and we have expert who will answer them based on the Noble Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. So today in our studio, we have the pleasure to be with Brother Miqdad, Islamic scholar. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Brother, you have been giving us, talking about the concept of ikram in Islam, you know, the giving self-respect. So when you talk about that, giving self-respect to our children in the previous episodes, could you elaborate on how this would impact social interactions and how children communicate and deal with the people around them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very, very important topic, the tarbiyah that allows a child to build what we call self-respect or self-esteem. Something we've talked about many times before, and related this to the social atmosphere, the social dimension, is very, very important. Just let me introduce this topic. You see, Islam teaches us that we need to live a life where we are part of a society. So in Islam, we don't have this concept of rahbaniyah, where people would go in the mountains, for example, and spend time in isolation.
Right.
Islam looks down upon. And our prophets were not like this. Our prophets, all of them, were part of the society. They would
social.
They would be socially active in order to interact in a positive way with others and be helpful to the society. And this is something that is a principle that we have in Islam. And therefore, the outlook that we need to have when we do child upbringing, when we train our children, is always to keep in mind that we want our children to be part of the society, but not just passively, but also be actively part of the society, and obviously be a positive member of the society, be a positive part of the society in a way that they can be helpful to the society, they can be a source of guidance, a sort of benefit for the society. So this is something that we have in Islam as a principle, and for all of us, we need to make sure that we live within the society. And this is why so many times previously we've talked about the importance of going to mosque, the importance of taking part in different social activities, in different sports activities, basically being part of the community, being involved within the community, and encouraging our children to also get involved within the community.
Right.
Now, when we do this, when we're part of the society, you will find that there are many challenges that come. Right. Naturally, being part of the society brings about conflict, brings about dispute. It can bring about different issues and challenges within a social context. And Islam teaches us that the very reason why we have been put in society and the very purpose behind society is exactly to allow you to overcome these challenges and as such grow from them, or grow in your ability to manifest the beautiful traits of Allah, and grow in your spiritual perfection and your moral perfection. In other words, if I can conclude this, it is through social relationships, through being part of the society, and through overcoming positively the different challenges that come when we're interacting with one another, that somebody is able to grow, is able to acquire the special traits, the human traits, and able to become generous, become patient, become tolerant, be able to stand for the truth, stand for justice. All these things are manifested within a social context.
Right. We'll discuss more with you, Brother McDowell, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab at your service. And we are with Brother McDowell talking about the society wherein Brother McDowell said that being social is natural. We are bound to be social. We are born to be social. Islam does not advocate the concept of being isolated. So, but when we live in society, many things come up. We have many challenges, and Islam guides us with its beautiful texts and narrations how to overcome these challenges and how can we adopt that when it comes to Islamic upbringing. Brother Miqdad is shedding more light on that.
When we look at children, children that are very young, so toddlers, you find that one of the characteristics of children is to be very selfish.
Okay.
Children want everything for themselves.
For themselves.
Right? They just look at themselves. They don't look at others. If they want, for example, a particular toy or a particular food, for example, it has to be given to them now and has to be given to them immediately. Immediately, right? It's not, I can't wait and I want it now, even though it might belong to somebody else. It might not be the right time. It might mean that people have to go through a lot of difficulty to get it. Children don't understand the concept of thinking about others, right? Naturally, the human being from the onset is selfish,
right?
And this is a natural trait, and this is how we've been created, right? Because our primary desires of this world are very material at the beginning, right? It is only when a child then grows up and starts to interact with different people, realizes that, hold on a second, we are different individuals, we all have our needs, and I can't be selfish and want things right now and everybody should be at my service. I have to understand that there are other factors involved in me acquiring what I want. And so therefore they learn to overcome their selfishness and look at others and be empathetic to others, understand different circumstances.
Right.
Children also enter conflicts because of the selfishness. Children don't like to share, right? Or they enter into conflicts. I want this. If somebody else wants it, it's okay. I want it first. I got there first. They enter into conflicts, and it is up to the parents and through time and through growth that they are able then to appreciate differences or appreciate the ability to connect with others in a way that is tolerant, in a way that you look at others first as well. Basically, children don't know how to, or first and foremost are selfish and involved within conflicts because of that. And so when we talk about ikram, when we talk about self-respect, what we're aiming for is that we teach children and we give them skills that they should grow up, and obviously it comes with time, with practice. They should grow up to be able to understand that they're part of a society,
right?
That they cannot get everything that they want whenever they want, that there are other people as well that also have needs, and that we should interact with one another with respect, with tolerance, appreciate differences, not get involved in conflicts, have concepts such as justice, such as patience, such as generosity. All these things are things that are built. And the key, or one of the very important keys in that is to have enough self-respect for that to, for those positive traits to
get really flourished.
Flourished and be inculcated in our children.
Right. We'll discuss more with you, Brother Miqdad, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Ya muqdiy al-khayrat, ya muqdiy al-khayrat, ya muqdiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are discussing how do we cultivate that self-respect in children when they are dealing in a society. Brother Miqdad, you said that living in a society in itself has some positive impacts, like children do understand what I need right now for just myself. That selfishness gets faded away when they face society, when they see the differences, when they, and obviously with the guidance of parents, the right guidance at the right time could help a lot. So what more do we have in the store?
What happens is that when children are able to grow up and they're treated with a lot of tolerance, they're treated with a lot of respect, right? If you have a family the father and the mother are treating their children in a very tolerant way.
Right.
And through their actions, they're showing that they're able to sacrifice for a child. They're able to show patience. They're able to speak in a nice way. They're able to overlook what they need for others. And children see this, right?
Right.
When they see, for example, my mom, she was hungry, but she still shared her food with me, for example.
Right.
Or, for example, my dad was tired, but still, when I asked for something, he went to get it for me.
Right.
They might not say it in their words, but they...
But they do understand.
Exactly. They understand it. The image remains in their mind, right?
Observing.
And as they grow up, right, and if circumstances come in society, whether they, when they go to school, for instance, or they go to mosque, for instance, and times of conflict arise, or a situation arises where they have to show sacrifice, they have to show respect, they have to show patience. What happens is that because they've seen that in their parents... they're much easier to then apply it and to show these things. And this is why, first and foremost, when we talk about upbringing in this way, is that parents should show it towards their children.
Right.
It's completely opposite to telling them what to do. See, you have one such situation where a child needs something, for example, and he asks his dad, and dad tells him, go get it yourself, right? Or right now I'm too busy, my work comes first, right? I don't have time for you right now. I have to do what I'm supposed to do.
Right.
Or they help the child, but with 100 words of minnat, 100 words of you're indebted to me, and I had so much to do, yet I sacrificed everything for you, and reminding him of everything they did for him, basically.
Right.
When children see this, right, they feel at that point they feel humiliated. They don't feel a sense of respect. They don't feel a sense of importance within themselves.
Even if you left your work for them, even if you did.
Exactly, because the words that you use, the lack of love and respect that you showed, all of this brings about a sense of lack of self-respect,
right.
Lack of self-importance. And
right.
Then when it comes for them to then show those traits, those important traits, what happens is that they are unable to do this because... One, they've got this image of in their minds of their parents how they behaved, and also within themselves they don't have any self respect, and therefore they're very easier to go on the side of conflict, aggression, and selfishness.
So the key point is lead by example yourself, because children learn more by observing than listening to you. Thank you so much, Brother Mikhtar, for being with us and helping us with those beautiful tips on Islamic upbringing. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also listen to our programs again on our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/gn. Go to the tab COI, Call of Islam, and you'll find an archive of our programs there. Well, you can also find us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Gaza's embattled hospitals are facing a total collapse as bombardments continue and Israeli tanks and troops surround medical facilities, patients and staff trapped inside. The Iranian president says that the U.S. is behind the Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. It's calling for designating the Israeli military as a terrorist entity.